We got Facebook, we got tariffs, we got a government spending plan. Who could ask for anything more? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Friday, March the 23rd. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Yes, fine, there was lots of political news this week. I will grant you that. I would offer, though, that the business and economic news was equally compelling and perhaps even more vital in the long run. So that is where we're going to start. Catherine Rempel is with The Washington Post. Rachel Abrams is with The New York Times. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hey.
So, Catherine, let me start with you. The president today signed, after saying he would veto, he signed the $1.3 trillion spending plan that gets us through the end of September. He did also say, though, that he's never, ever going to sign another one of these omnibus spending plans again. And I wonder if the president has perhaps backed himself into a corner, given the way the Congress of the United States works.
I don't think he's going to actually keep to that promise. like many other things that he has said that he has since walked back or changed his mind on, this seems like it would be very difficult to keep to, given our pattern in the last few years, maybe decades, I think, at this point, of not actually passing budget bills on any sort of regular order schedule.
Rachel, though, it was kind of an extraordinary moment in the diplomatic room of the White House. The president took a long, long time to air a long list of grievances about the way the government gets funded and what's in this bill and what's not.
Yeah. And I mean, the whole day has been a bit of sort of political whiplash for people living in Washington and or anybody really following this. You know, I think that Republican leaders were pretty confident that the president was going to sign this. And then he comes out and says that he's not going to sign it. And then he eventually, of course, does. And one of the things that's sort of interesting about this is, you know, if the government had actually shut down, it's not like we haven't seen shutdowns before, but this one would have been solely the responsibility of the president, which probably would have cost a lot of political capital that nobody really, or he didn't want to spend.
Right.
It's not clear what he would have gotten out of it.
Yeah.
Also.
Other than just being able to say, I did this, right? I mean, which would seem to be, in his vernacular, no small thing, right?
I mean, if he wants to throw a tantrum, he can throw a tantrum, but it's not clear what policy objective he would actually achieve.
All right. So let's change policy objectives here for a second from funding the federal government and fiscal policy to trade policy. Catherine, I want to play a piece of tape from the announcement event that the president held. I think it was Wednesday, announcing those China specific tariffs, $60 billion worth of imported goods that he wants to put extra duties on. And he said this, talking about the Chinese government.
I've been speaking with the highest Chinese representatives, including the president, and I've asked them to reduce the trade deficit immediately by $100 billion. It's a lot.
It is a lot. But, Catherine, let me ask you this. And you and I and others in this segment have talked before about how the president is perhaps economically inconsistent. He doesn't seem to realize that when we send $100 billion of American money over to China, we get stuff from them. And that's the way trade deficits work.
Yes. American consumers benefit from the fact that we can buy lots of cheap Chinese products. And if you're going to complain about something that the Chinese government has been doing, you should be complaining about their IP violations, their intellectual property violations, which is actually what this memorandum was supposed to be targeting. Besides, you know, forget what actually Trump said in that signing ceremony. The thing that China has been doing wrong has been basically stealing our IP or forcing American companies to hand over their technology if they want access to the Chinese market. And that's what we should be targeting. And there's a smart way to do that, which is like through the WTO, for example, or working with our allies, and there's a dumb way, which is tariffs, and unfortunately, Trump is emphasizing the tariffs.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about IP, actually, in a minute with Jennifer Pack from Shanghai, but that's exactly the point. Rachel, let me play another piece of tape for you. This one is Wilbur Ross, the Secretary of Commerce, on CNBC after that same event, and here is what the Secretary of Commerce said. Here he is, Wilbur Ross.
Oh, I think there will be some ultimate retaliation, but I don't think it's going to be the end of the earth.
So, first of all, not the end of the earth seems an interesting way to approach trade policy. But more to the point, the phrase trade war is getting bandied about quite a bit, but it's a real issue for a lot of people.
It is. And I think what you're seeing now is, and maybe this is sort of reflected in Wilbur Ross's statements, it might not be the end of the earth at this moment, that the tariffs that China imposed on American products, on fruit, pork, wine and a couple other things. They're not as extreme as China could be imposing. They're as Catherine mentioned when we were chatting earlier, they're sort of feeling us out. You know, if China decided to, say, put a tariff on soybeans, which is a major U.S. export to China, that would be apocalyptic for a lot of our soybean growers in the United States. So these are really meant to kind of send a warning shot over the tariffs that we put on steel and aluminum, but it could get a lot worse, basically.
In a very short period of time. Rachel Abrams at the New York Times, Catherine Rampell from the Washington Post in our studios in New York. Thanks, you two.
Thanks,
guys. All right. Have a nice weekend. Wall Street today was fine until it wasn't. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A little more on tariffs and trade now, because there are all kinds of ways this could go sideways in a hurry. As Catherine was just talking about, the White House justified the China-specific tariffs the president announced this week as a response to Chinese intellectual property theft and of Beijing forcing American firms to transfer technology to Chinese partners as a condition for market access over there. Our China correspondent Jennifer Peck has the view from Shanghai.
China says it does not want a trade war, but it's not afraid of one either. Hua Chunying is with the Chinese Foreign Ministry and spoke ahead of President Trump's announcement yesterday. China will surely take all necessary measures to safeguard its legitimate rights and interests. If the U.S. goes ahead with the tariffs, China's Ministry of Commerce has listed 128 American products it could target for retaliation, including pork, wine, and fresh fruit. The goods have an import value of $3 billion, a fraction of what the U.S. is planning. At the same time, senior officials in China appear to be dangling some carrots. Earlier this week, Premier Li Keqiang has said the government will fully open its manufacturing sector and that it will not force foreign companies to transfer technology when they want to operate in the Chinese market. Jake Parker with the U.S.-China Business Council in Beijing welcomes the news, but he says this is rhetoric unless China removes its other barriers.
Before a company can begin the construction of a new manufacturing facility, there's a requirement that they undergo an environmental impact assessment.
He says companies have given information considered trade secrets during the process, and the results, he says, are reviewed by a local expert panel.
We've heard from members that those experts can sometimes be competitors from industry. So these individuals are gaining access to very sensitive information and trade secrets.
Some American businesses agree that China has improved its record on protecting intellectual property, but they say only incrementally. International trade expert Tu Xinquan says China just needs time.
The IP system was invented in the West. After the founding of the People's Republic of China in 1949, there was no concept of private property. Everything was publicly owned.
China says if America really wants to balance its trade deficit, there is a simpler way. Officials here have called on the U.S. government to stop blocking exports of American high-tech goods to China. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
There are, as you know, though, two sets of tariffs on the table, the China-specific ones that Jennifer was just talking about, and the steel and aluminum duties that go into effect today, depending on who you are. The European Union and six other countries have been exempted, at least for now, till May the 1st is when that exemption runs out. But European leaders are distinctly underwhelmed by the reprieve. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
The U.S. postponed the imposition of tariffs on European steel and aluminum to May the 1st to give the Europeans time to make progress in reducing their trade surplus with America. Charles de Lusignan of the European Steel Association is not reassured.
There is the very present risk that in 5 weeks' time we will be back in a crisis situation. So it's not over yet.
EU politicians and diplomats have made it clear they're happy to talk about any aspect of transatlantic trade, but not with the threat of the steel tariffs hanging over their heads. Sam Lowe of the Centre for European Reform.
It's not in the EU's interest to go along with the US at the end of a gun, because ultimately you just don't know when Trump may decide to pull the trigger.
Meanwhile, the Europeans have kept their own gun cocked and ready to fire. Today, the EU repeated it would hit back with retaliatory tariffs against US exports if the bloc is hit with steel duties. There's now a serious risk of a global trade war, says Nairi Woods, professor of global economic governance at Oxford University, and she blames the US for starting it.
History teaches us that it's a pretty powerful signal when the United States unilaterally announces tariffs. When it did it in 1930, some would say it caused the Great Depression.
This week, the top trade representatives from the US and the EU said they would begin urgent talks to address trade concerns. But the European officials stressed those talks should not be subject to what she called artificial deadlines. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
One imagines the strategizing at Facebook headquarters the past week or so has been intense, especially around what CEO Mark Zuckerberg and his number two COO Sheryl Sandberg would say, as in what actual words they would use. I mention that because both of them said essentially the same thing in their various media appearances the past couple of days, that they would be open to regulation. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore takes a look at what that might and might not look like.
Mark Zuckerberg flat out told CNN that maybe Facebook should be regulated.
You know, there are things like ads transparency regulation that I would love to see.
Political ads on TV and radio have to say, this ad was paid for by whatever campaign, for example. There is a bill floating around Congress that would bring Facebook ads in line with TV and radio ads.
We've actually already started rolling out ad transparency tools that accomplish most of the things that are in all the bills that people are talking about today.
But Facebook has also lobbied against some of those bills. Alex Howard helped write one, the Honest Ads Act. Howard is deputy director of the Sunlight Foundation.
Contrary to what Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg asserted, Facebook is not currently moving towards the full transparency that this would represent.
And the range of regulations proposed for Facebook doesn't stop at requiring disclosure of who's funding political ads. In Europe, where regulators are stricter about data and privacy, they're considering rules on how consumer data can be used, how it can be shared, what permissions are required, and what privacy rights consumers are entitled to.
You're about to see Marguerite Vestager, the commissioner on EU competitiveness, go gangster on big tech.
Scott Galloway is professor of marketing at NYU's Stern School of Business. Back in Washington, though...
In Washington, I don't think you're likely to see anything. I don't believe that D.C. has the collective will or domain expertise to take on big tech.
The Honest Ads Act is languishing in committee in the Senate. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Even though it's just a piece of paper or something you carry around, it is something that helps you work being somebody here.
Immigration documentation really is more than just a piece of paper. But first, let's do the numbers. Well, there you go. The Wawa trombones on a Friday. Dow Industrials off 424 today, 1.7%, 23,533. The NASDAQ off 174 points, about 2.4%, 69.92. The S&P 500 gave back 55 points, about 2.1%, 25.88. For the week, the 5 days gone by, the Dow gave back 5.6%. The NASDAQ declined 6.5%. The S&P 500 off 5.9%. Rising trade tensions between the U.S. and China hit chip makers, many of which sell a lot of their products in China. Applied Materials turned down 6% today. Micron Technology tumbled 7.9% despite posting better than expected second quarter earnings. Facebook off 3.3% today, still hurt by recent revelations having to do with that Cambridge Analytica thing. Bond prices rose, yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.81%. You're listening to Marketplace. You go first this time.
Hey, I'm Molly Wood.
And I'm Kai Rizdahl.
Our podcast, Make Me Smart, is back, and we are exploring something you need to succeed in business, politics, you know, basically everywhere.
It is the art, the lost art, some might say, of compromise.
Yeah, because this country is not going to get where it needs to go. Frankly, you and your boss are not going to get where you need to go if you cannot even get people in the room.
We're not doing the room.
The
right
room
now.
Where it happens.
We're not.
How come we can't? Can we just compromise on this one issue?
No.
Just sing like a little bit?
No. Check us out at makemesmart.org or wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. A word now about the weather. Not the actual thing, not nor'easters or rain like we've had in L.A., but the version of it you see on television. The Weather Channel has been bought by media entrepreneur Byron Allen for a reported $300 million, which is interesting because a decade ago, it went for $3.5 billion. Things have obviously changed at the company and in the business of weather data since then because, I mean, really, what's an all-weather, all-the-time TV station worth in this era of iPhone weather apps? Marketplace's Aaron Schrank has that one.
Allen is paying much less than current owners Comcast, Blackstone Group, and Bain Capital did, mostly because they spun off and sold the company's digital assets a few years ago for $2 billion. That included the popular weather.com. Media analyst Jimmy Scheffler at the Carmel Group says the remaining TV network isn't as valuable.
The value of the brand and the value of the service has declined, and it has been replaced by things like your Apple iPhone.
With continued cord cutting and declining TV viewership, Scheffler thinks the Weather Channel is a risky bet for Allen, who owns several cable networks like Pets TV and online media, including The Griot.
Can this traditional channel compete against new kinds of digital information delivery?
The answer is no, says Joel Espelin, senior analyst at the Diffusion Group. When it comes to local weather info, smartphone apps have already taken over.
But these big storms, whether it's national or global weather events, it's harder to get the flavor of those things from a phone. And the Weather Channel's pretty good at that.
In fact, the week Hurricane Harvey hit, it was the number one cable channel in advertisers' coveted 25 to 54 age group. As climate change drives more severe weather events, Espelin says the Weather Channel's ratings could spike.
The reality is weather is one of the few remaining sort of true mass market experiences that bring wide audiences together.
He says in a fragmented, maybe even polarized society, we can always still talk about the weather. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
As Rachel Catherine and I were talking about a bit up at the beginning, President Trump has in fact signed the bill keeping the government open until the end of September, although amid great protestation, as I noted. The thing is 2,232 pages long, so we're going to be going through it for a while trying to see how Congress and the White House are spending taxpayer money. Of interest, though, is something that's not in it, a last-ditch compromise on health care. It's what's known as a stabilization package designed to keep health insurance premiums on the individual market, that is, Obamacare, from going up a lot. It also would have restored billions of dollars in federal subsidies to insurance companies, payments the Trump administration stopped last year. Seeing as how 31% of Americans in our most recent Marketplace Edison Research poll said healthcare was their top economic concern of all, we asked Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman to explore what happens now.
Two things happened last year to destabilize Obamacare. First, Congress got rid of the individual mandate, the penalty for not buying health insurance. That's likely to leave older, sicker people in the market, driving up premiums, explains Larry Levitt at the Kaiser Family Foundation.
This bill would have provided payments to insurance companies for high-cost enrollees, essentially offsetting the premium increase resulting from repeal of the individual mandate.
Second, President Trump stopped cost-sharing payments to insurance companies to subsidize low- and middle-income people. Healthcare analyst Robert Leshevsky says without money from Congress,
it's likely that insurance companies are going to raise their rates substantially, perhaps in the range of 30%.
Now, keep in mind, this is only for the individual market, roughly 15 to 20 million Americans. And lower-income people on the exchanges simply get more government help when premiums go up. So this mostly affects people who earn too much to be eligible for subsidies, says Peter Lee at the Covered California Exchange.
For about 6 to 7 million Americans that don't get that financial help, they pay every dollar of these premium increases.
And Leshevsky says the insurance companies
are going to get their premiums. They're either going to get it from the federal government or they're going to charge the consumer more.
Premiums for 2019 will be announced next fall, right around the midterm elections. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Sticking with that theme of what didn't make it into the spending bill, we're going to turn to immigration now, DACA, or more specifically, a fix for the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. Federal courts have stepped in to temporarily block President Trump's decision to end protections for the 800,000 or so people brought into this country illegally as children. Congress and the White House haven't been able to come to terms on it, so for now, any kind of permanent solution is nowhere. Marketplace's Rima Kreis has this story of two DACA recipients and what feels like endless uncertainty.
I first met Carlos Rodriguez last summer at one of his favorite coffee shops in South Los Angeles, close to where he grew up. He was a chatty 17-year-old who had just graduated from high school and had a few good options for college.
Princeton, Columbia, Yale, Harvard.
I checked in with him a couple weeks ago to see how things are going at Yale.
Hello.
Hey, Carlos, it's Rima.
Hi, Rima, how are you?
I'm good, how are you? Carlos was born in Mexico and is undocumented. He says he chose Yale because the students, including his older brother, seemed happy there. And Yale's president had been outspoken about how the school would protect DACA recipients.
It's like almost near the end of my first year, which is, I think, insane. I feel really comfortable on campus and, you know, it just feels like this is where I should have been.
And he says he feels comfortable having his classmates know he's undocumented, though he's still getting used to their reactions. Like that time he told some friends he's not eligible for federal financial aid.
And they were just like super like confused. And they're just like, oh, my God, like how do you pay for college?
Scholarships, a lot of them. Carlos had been in school for just a few weeks when President Trump ordered an end to the DACA program.
That was heartbreaking because it was like the one thing we had. Even though we knew it wasn't enough, it was still something.
Trump gave Congress 6 months to come up with a fix. It didn't. Meanwhile, the courts have stepped in, temporarily blocking Trump's order and allowing DACA recipients to renew their status. That's good, says Carlos.
But at the same time, I think it made Congress kind of like say, oh, well, okay, the courts ruled, they're fine. They can just keep applying.
Now, with no real legislative solution in sight, Carlos says he and his brother feel more anxious about the future.
Yeah, if we have a Yale degree, that's great. But if I'm not given the legal right to work, then what is a Yale degree going to do? No one's going to want to employ me.
The possibility that they won't be able to work legally in the U.S. is rattling a lot of DACA recipients, especially younger ones. Hey.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Good to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Jackie is a soft-spoken 20-year-old. She has glossy brown hair and a wrist tattoo with her mom's initials. They're close. Her mom brought her across the border to Los Angeles from El Salvador when she was just a kid. And today, they share a bed in a house with four other relatives.
I mean, it's kind of awkward just because I don't have, like, my own space, but...
It's temporary, she says, until she can save up. After she graduated from high school, Jackie trained to become a medical assistant.
My goal is to become a registered nurse. I thought that was a start.
She says she wasn't too worried about reaching that goal until DACA was thrown into doubt.
Even though it's just a piece of paper or something you carry around, it is something that helps you work, you know, being somebody here.
Then she got a letter from Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, calling her status here into question. She immediately saw a lawyer.
And I asked her, I was like, so can you go with me? And she's like, oh, no, you'll be fine, like. They won't do anything to you.
Jackie says when she showed up for her appointment, a deportation officer told her she could be sent back to El Salvador.
The moment was just so surreal. I was like, but why are you guys taking me if I have DACA? And he's like, no, your DACA has been expired. And I was like, my DACA's not expired. My DACA's still running.
She was right. But her situation is complicated because of her mom's status. And Jackie will have to check in with ICE again in a few months. She says she feels like DACA...
I feel like it should protect me. That's what I thought, you know.
Lately, she says it's been hard to sleep, not knowing what could happen. But she says, sadly, that fear of being torn apart has brought her family closer together. These days, they're sitting around the dinner table more often, just in case. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, we did something this week I don't think we've ever done on this program. We took an hour-long interview about the economic event of our lifetimes and put it on the radio. Hank Paulson, Ben Bernanke, and here, Tim Geithner, talking about the financial crisis 10 years ago.
Everybody's instinct is to let the thing burn.
Yeah.
Because it seems just to let it burn. But if you let the thing burn to the point the system collapses, you're going to be left with hundreds of millions of innocent victims. What feels unjust in the context of breaking a panic is the most just thing to do if your interest is trying to prevent the economy from mass unemployment or a decade of breadlines across the country like what happened in the Great Depression.
The three of them aren't going to be talking together publicly about the crisis again until September and the 10th anniversary of Lehman Brothers. So if you want to hear them, we are your go-to. We put the whole hour in the Marketplace podcast feed, or you can hear it at marketplace.org. All right, we got to go. The Dow Industrials off 424 points today, 1.7%. NASDAQ off 174, 2.4%. S&P 500 dropped 55, about 2.1%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Our executive editor is Evelyn LaRubia. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you on Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.